Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with actress Scout Taylor Compton and art curators Beth Carter and Aaliyah Boubard. That's coming up on Endeavors. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Apologies for the sound of my voice. I've been fighting off, I think, a thing or two as the weather finally changes for the better here. And speaking of things that are better and good and great, it's a great lineup for today's show. We have Scout Taylor Compton, who is on the show talking about her new film, Best Man, and something I've never had a chance to do before, a couple of art curators, Beth Carter and Aaliyah Boubard from the Bill Reed Gallery in Vancouver, talked to me about the Canadian premiere of the new group exhibition, Bright Futures. But I'm going to start now, like I usually do, with film. And Scout Taylor Compton has been in film for most of her life. She was a child star in such films as 13 Going on 30, and Sleepover, and then she found herself as a scream queen in such films as Halloween, Halloween 2, An American Crime, Ghost House, The Lurker, and The Long Night. As well as appearing in other such films as The Runaways, where she played Lita Ford opposite Kristen Stewart and Dakota Fanning. Return to Sender, Triple Dog opposite Canada's Alexia Fast. Apache Junction, where she starred with Stuart Townsend, Trace Adkins, and Thomas Jane. And she's also appeared in a litany of television shows, including Ally McBeal, Charmed, ER, Gilmore Girls, Frasier, Unfabulous, Cold Case, That's So Raven, Without a Trace, Bones, CSI, CSI New York, NCIS, Los Angeles, Grey's Anatomy, Nashville, and Rosewood. Her latest film, as mentioned, is The Best Man, in which she gets to play opposite Dolph Lundgren, Luke Wilson, and Brendan Fair. It is a action comedy thriller film about a wedding party that gets taken hostage, and it's up to the groom, his best friend, and the drunken best man to save the day. It came out on Friday, the 21st, and this is my conversation with Scout Taylor Compton. You.
Great. You have 20 minutes for your interview.
Thank you very much.
Awesome. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Nice. Great. Good. I'm glad.
Yeah. Had a chance to meander through through the best man.
Nice.
And in a weird way, this feels like a bit of a departure for you, I think. I think because a lot of your fans connect you so much to the Scream Queen and the horror things, this feels like a slight change of pace. Would yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm not covered in blood. I'm not screaming. I'm not crashing through a window. I'm not possessed. I mean, it is still like, it is still, you know, a lot of physicality to it. So they yeah. kind of come hand in hand. But at least I don't have to, you know, have blood stains all over me, which is great.
Yeah. nice not to be the focus of all the effects for once, right?
yes. I mean, you stay on set for like an hour after everybody wraps, just getting all of that stuff removed from you rather than just like bailing like all the men do.
Haley seems like maybe she's a bit of a seductress in a way. What do you think her motives are? It, like, especially when it comes to her and Bradley.
Oh God, where is this going? Can I curse?
No, absolutely.
I feel like this is internet radio. Okay. I feel like Haley is just trying to get laid. It's what she was trying to do in the beginning. I think she was like, I mean, I only hear stories of like this, and obviously we've all seen Wedding Crasher. I feel like she was just like, you know, you hear about this where like people are like, oh yeah, that person hooked up with that guest. I'm like, what? What wedding were you at? Never been to a wedding and like scoping out the you know, what's available. But she definitely was. She was like, what is my next dessert? And let's figure it out. Which was fun to play because that's so not me. So that was really, it was interesting to find that within myself. To play that sort of character and to work with Brendan. I mean, he's so easy to work with. So it was nice to be able to be flirty with someone that I already know and have done a couple movies with, and he's a respectable man and has a wife. So it was really great.
Speaking of people you get to work with, Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah. Man, everyone is so stoked about Dolph. I love it. Everyone is like so excited about Dolph. You know, it was quite an experience working with him. I was very like captivated by just his presence. I mean, he's like a big guy, but he just is such a sweetheart and so down to like play and do whatever like needs to be done for any movie that he needs to do, which is kind of like how I am. Like, he's not afraid to get dirty, which was amazing. Cause like sometimes when you see like a polished actor, you're kind of like, uh-oh, like what am I getting into? But he was just like so down to do whatever it takes. And he was quite a legend to be around for sure. You felt it.
We're seeing kind of this movement of, you know, the more indie, lower budget action film, which I think the horror genre pioneered. And Corey Large, who's on one of the EPs on this, has done a very good job of that type of film. What do you like about like that environment, that type of set, and just this overall kind of movement that's happening?
I mean, about time, right? all these actors and all these producers and all these directors, all these talents are like, hey, when's it my turn? You know, I'm here over here too. I think that's opened a window for all those incredible people that have kind of been waiting in the background for their chance. And I also think like I'm a big person on in community and family and working together as a whole. And I feel like that you feel that way more when you do like an independent feature. Like, it's just, everybody is just like, it's like you're trying to raise a baby at the same time. Everyone's just doing their part to like raise this kid and make it the best that it can be. And you feel that. And there's a lot more freedom, you know, there's a lot more like you're kind of playing around and you're discovering together. It's kind of like how you do at, when you do a play, you know, you guys are all just figuring it out and you want to put the best material forward and everyone's just like, you know, doing their best, which, this was one of those. I mean, you felt it. Everybody knew what they were doing. And when we were on set, it was really incredible to see the magic happen.
You know, Haley's a little bit devious, but I also find her character incredibly funny. And I know we haven't seen you do a lot of comedy, but is that an area you want to explore more?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I never do comedy. I never do. And I think comedy scares me. It's so funny because I always thought it was like beats, you know, you need beats. But if you play it straight, it comes out funny. So having that understanding, thank you. That means so much to me because I've always been like afraid of it. But I'm down to do anything, to be honest. I just love this world, this acting world. And I just have so much fun. I mean, I just did 2 rom-coms back to back because I had so much fun. I was like, I'll do your next one. This was a blast. So it's just the filmmaking, you know, I just love every genre.
Well, speaking of doing many things, I think I read on your IMDb that you have 8 projects in various stages of production. Yeah. But one that I am really intrigued by is you're going to be in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre video game.
Yes, I am. I know. You know, I was hoping by the time I did this press that they would announce who I am, but they are not. I mean, the game comes out, God, I want to say like September. Like we're doing a massive like press party for it. But they haven't announced who I am. So I can't really like talk too much about it, but I voiced one of the characters as well as did all of the, you know, the body work for the characters as well. It was a lot of hard work. I never imagined a video game. I mean, you know, when we do a horror movie, we have anywhere from 18 to 30 days of filming. Here, it's like 7 days of doing the body elements and my character is getting killed by each and every one of them. So it's acting out each and every different deaths, different ways. And there's all these different types of dying and crawling and hiding and jumping and all this. And then you go into the ADR and you voice one and it's 3 hours of doing a movie. It was so much work, but it was such a blast. It was so cool.
Did you get to interact with Kane Hodder at all? Speaking of horror legends.
I love Kane. My God, I love Kane so much. I swear, he is like such a jokester and has such a potty mouth. It's so nuts. And he was actually stunting a lot of our, like the video game stuff that we had to do. So he was actually the stunt coordinator. So I worked with him very, very hands-on on how to get hit, how to take a chainsaw, how to whatever I had to do. So there was a lot of cool stuff. And there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that I feel like fans will really, really love.
And it just must be cool just to be a part of, like, that's a pretty iconic franchise up there with like Halloween and Elm Street and Friday.
Yeah, man, I am so honored to be able to be a part of 2 franchises. I just hope it doesn't stop there because I mean, I love that genre so much. And, you know, the fan base is just like my favorite people like out there. I like absolutely adore this genre and the fan base behind it. I mean, I was a fan of Texas Chainsaw probably before Halloween, just because of like the family affair of it all. I was just like, this is insane. I had never seen anything like it. And so when I got asked to do the video game, I was like, yes, I don't care. We're doing it.
Do you think you could see yourself maybe writing and directing a horror film?
Yes, that's actually what I am doing currently.
Oh, wow.
Yes, there's a lot of stuff in the works for me with directing some movies in the future, and as well as writing and directing and coming up with Danielle Harris and myself, or we're kind of using the formula that American Horror Story has. And we're going to do a horror movie a year starring her and I, but kind of all different. I mean, we know what the fans want, man.
Right. Yeah,
we know what they want. So we're going to do it.
Why do you think a lot of, you know, performers that started out as child stars and teen actors often gravitate towards that route of behind the scenes?
You know, I think it's because, I mean, we've been born into this. Like Danielle and I both started as a young age. Like I said before, it's a community effort, you know? And if you're not a fan of what each and every one of these people do that make a movie, then I don't really think that this is the field for you. Like, this is it takes an army to make this. And I am absolutely like obsessed with each and every one of it. I always want to know how the camera works. I always want to know about the shots. I always want to know about the lenses. I always want to know about, like, you know, the style, the wardrobe, like the color palette that they're choosing. I mean, there's just so much that goes into it. And all of it, I think, is just like, it's also a different type of lingo. Like, I don't think like a dentist could come in and be like, what are you guys talking about? Like, it's just
right.
Different lingo. And once you get it, it's like you're hooked. So you can't speak it. It's in language. You can't speak any other language.
I was talking with one of our ADs yesterday, and, you know, she was talking like, okay, back on, I need you to banana this way, you know? And then like someone coming on us to be like, apple boxes, bananas, pancakes. Where are you? Are you a film set? Or are you a breakfast joint? Like, what's going on?
Yeah. I mean, it is really fun to be able to teach people, like, even like 10-1, 10-2, like, it's just like, it's some things that nobody will ever understand, but it's oh God, it's like, it's
circus window. Abby.
Yeah. I could go to sleep with that lingo.
I know. Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. We sort of joked about how part of this film, you know, it's all the hijinks at the wedding. And it kind of also reminds me of like a kind of like a high school reunion type thing in a way. What do you think has more drama hijinks, a wedding or a reunion?
Oh God. I don't know. I think they're both equally as like fun. Maybe a wedding. Maybe.
Open bar, right?
Yeah, open bar. That's what takes you in. As I'm planning my wedding right now, I'm like, that is key. What do people need? Open bar, great food, and dancing. That's it.
Yeah.
You got them under your spell.
Does doing a show like this make you worried for your wedding at all?
Oh my, you know, I didn't think about that until I started doing these interviews, and I was like, oh my God, I hope my wedding doesn't turn like this. You know, hopefully nothing goes. I think the only thing crazy that'll happen at my wedding is if somebody's like too drunk, right. You know, like that. That's it. Hopefully that's all that happens, or someone like passes out because of how much walking my venue has. I don't know.
Yeah, but you know, are you doing the whole like grand hotel overlooking the mountains like they are? And
no, I'm doing Santa Cruz in the trees with some cabins. That's what I'm doing.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah, it's really nice. We're having pizza and tacos. Like, it's gonna be great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Italian Mexican fusion, right?
Yeah, there, it's gonna be good. My signature drink is gonna be a michelada. So it's gonna
Ooh,
be nice.
Love me, Nicolata. Yeah, there are so many great moments, you know, both funny and terrifying in this film. Do you have one or two scenes that stick out to you that were your favorite?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I mean, obviously, like, I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but any of like the stunt fights, the stunt guys were so great. My fiance worked with their brother on Star Wars. So it was really like, I was like, oh my God, my fiance is working with your brother on Star Wars. And so it was his, so it was like kind of like, you know, connecting the dots. And I knew that the stunts were going to be really, really great. So any of like the fight scenes, like Brendan's big epic fight scene, I was there recording every moment of it. I was like, oh my God, this is going to be so epic. You're going to get slung over here and all that kind of stuff. And then also, I think like our,
you know, that when you really, really get to know Haley, I feel is the pool scene with Brendan and I. And Brendan and I had, I mean, we kind of had a little bit of say with the direction that that scene took, because it actually was just, I mean, it just said like they're in their bathing suit, their bras and panties in the spa talking. And I was like, no, no, no. I was like, Brendan, we're gonna make this playful. And so we kind of, Brendan and I choreographed this thing. I was like, Brendan, you trust me? Like, let's just like have fun with it. And so I think that that added to their connection and their energy with one another.
Yeah, I think especially when you throw him in,
I've done this before. I was like, have you guys? And everybody was like, Scout, we're gonna go in our clothes. It's like, yeah, that's like the fun of it. Like, have you never pulled anyone in the pool with their clothes on? Like, I can't be the only one that's done that, right?
Yeah. So
it was fun to be able to be like, just trust me, it's gonna be great.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you bring up the choreography of that scene, because those types of scenes in particular, the more intimate ones, are in the press a lot now with, you know, intimacy coordinators and, you know, how controlled those sets are. And there have been, you know, some pushback from older, you know, maybe older industry people. What do you make of all the dialogue that is happening around those scenes and all the progress we've made in making those scenes as authentic as possible?
Yeah, you know, it's so hard. It's so hard because I get the pros and I get the cons of it as well, because I'm a free spirit. So like, I just did a movie with Chrissy Metz that's coming out soon, and you know, we had an intimacy coordinator there for just a kiss, like literally a peck. And it was like a big deal, like stop production. Let's all talk about it. Like, where's your hand going to go? Where's that hand going to go? And it was just like, well, now you're just kind of taking like now I feel like a robot, you know? So I get it. I get it, because I've also, unfortunately, have been on set in the past where things went a little too far, and I didn't have anyone to go to. And it was when I had just turned 18, and I was on a set where someone got very handsy, and the director didn't see, director was pressuring me. So was the actor, and there was no women on set. And I looked around and were a bunch of men, and it was early in the morning in Albuquerque. And so that means in LA, nobody was up. So I couldn't get a hold of anybody. So I kind of felt pressured in doing the scene that I didn't really, really want to do. So I get it. I mean, I understand both things, but I'm hoping that it doesn't go to a level that is that changes these scenes and don't make them like as precious as they are, and hopefully not so robotic. I think there's a happy medium.
Yeah.
You know, like a kiss, like we don't need, okay, it's just, if I'm picking someone, I'm going to kiss them. Don't give me instructions.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, the last series I did, you know, like we had an intimacy coordinator, but it was in conjunction with the other actor. I was like, okay, what do you want it for? Like, you're okay with it throughout this, but you want it for this. Right. So I think you're right. Like, it's very, very much a.
Yeah. You gotta, I think because they didn't have that element. You know what I want to know? I want to know, where is the person in there when people are doing like getting shot in the head, getting shot in the stomach, getting stabbed to death, getting murdered? Like, where is the person that like goes up to the actor and goes, okay, this is actually, no, this is not real. Like, how are you feeling? Are you okay? And I only experienced this, and Chrissy Metz talked about it on my podcast. You know, Danielle, like myself, I've done so many horror movies that like I can do that shit in my sleep and be fine. But if you're coming on a set and this is your first time getting shot by a special effect, like by a little thing, by a pellet or any sort of thing, and you haven't experienced that ever, like that can be traumatic for someone. And I never think about it because I've done this so much. I'm like, what do you want to do? How many stabs? Okay, great. Got it. Let's go.
And finally, you know, you are so very much identified with the horror genre, and you're writing a horror script. I'm writing a horror script. I have friends that are writing horror scripts. What makes a good horror film?
Oh my God. There's so many things that could make a horror movie. I think playing with the senses, I think, is really, really great. I love, you know, with horror movies, it's like really give your characters like a backstory. Like that's like that I'm 100%. Just write a movie like you're writing a drama when you're writing a horror movie. Like you have to fall in love with these sort of characters. And then obviously like the epic like kills, you know, I feel like you have to have good kills. You have to have unique ones as well. Cause like it's so many things have already been done. But I think there's so many different formulas to a good horror movie, which I think is why the genre is so successful. Cause you can do, it's so out of the box. You can do whatever you want.
Well, The Best Man, which is not necessarily horror, but very much action thriller. It's a great film and it comes out, is it this right? No, next. Yeah,
April 21st.
April 21st. Yes. Perfect. Well, I hope all the listeners get a chance to see it, and they can enjoy a little, you know, a little wedding. They can enjoy a little action. They can enjoy you. They can enjoy Dolph Lundgren. They can enjoy. Yes. They can enjoy everything.
Yeah, that's what makes a good action movie, right there. I love it.
There you go, Scout. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you so much.
Alrighty, take care.
Bye, you too. Bye.
That was my conversation with Scout Taylor Compton. She's in the new film, Best Man, which is out now. I don't get to do a lot of art on the show. And, you know, by art, I mean painting, sculpture, carving, that sort of thing. But Canada has a long history of great artists of that nature, and particularly Indigenous art. And one such Indigenous artist was Bill Reed. He was Haida, and he specialized in sculpture, also did paintings, jewelry, screen printing, and producing over 1,000 original works. And in Canada, at least, and on the Pacific Northwest, where I live, he's regarded as one of the most significant Northwest Coast artists, you know, of the late, at least of the late 20th century. And he has a gallery named after him, the Bill Reed Gallery, which has a new exhibit coming out titled Bright Futures, and it examines the lasting influence of Bill Reed's iconic art on the development and creation of contemporary Northwest Coast art today, 25 years after his death. And so they've selected some of his works from the gallery's permanent collection, as well as selected works from 14 emerging and established Northwest Coast's artists, who are Squamish, Haida, Salish, Nuxnalth, Lekwungen, Tlingit, Temishmian, Selkirk, and Gitsan. The exhibit is co-curated by Beth Reed, who is the Bill Reed Gallery curator, and Aliyah Boubacht, who is the assistant curator of the gallery. They have a special opening night on the 25th, and then the exhibit opens April 26th and runs through January 14th. This is my conversation with Beth Carter and Olia Bubard. I am here with Beth and Alia from the Bill Reed Gallery. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It is afternoon, yes.
So you have a new event coming up at the Bill Reed Gallery starting in about 10 days. Bright Futures. Tell us a little bit about how this event came to pass.
Well, I'll start. My name's Beth Carter. I'm the curator here at the Bill Reed Gallery of Northwest Coast Art in downtown Vancouver. And we celebrate the work of Bill Reed, who is a one of the most famous Indigenous artists who passed away 25 years ago this year. So we both celebrate his, we have a permanent exhibition of his art, and also we celebrate his legacy, which we interpret as meaning all of the people that he has inspired and mentored and impressed over the years. And so we were pondering this idea of where has Northwest Coast art, and we are a contemporary art gallery, and Bill was a very contemporary artist. So we are pondering the idea of what would Bill think of how Northwest Coast art has developed and grown and expanded in the 25 years since his death. And then since we can't really speak for him, we can only guess and think about it. We decided that we better ask artists what they thought might have been some of the reasons they continue to be inspired by Bill Reed, even 25 years after he's been gone. And we put a call for artists out and invited artists to submit works and to basically speak to this question of Bill Reed's continued influence on the scene. So from that call out, we worked with a small team to selection committee to select. In the end, we selected 14 artists. Two are working as a collaborative team. So there'll be 13 contemporary new works coming into the exhibition. Some are pre-existing, but some are being created just for the show. And then we are pairing them together with some of the most amazing Bill Reed works as in our permanent collection, and building that conversation. So that's the sort of subtext of the exhibition. It opens on Wednesday, April 26th, but we are having an opening celebration the night before on the 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. and that's open to the public. So we hope people will come by.
You know, you get all these submissions for this event. How do you go about choosing which artists you want to feature and then pairing them up with an iconic Bill Reed piece of art?
I think that kind of came afterwards. We kind of were initially just looking at the submissions that we got, and then once we actually chose the artists themselves, then we paired it up with art from Bill Reed that we thought was relevant. In terms of choosing the artists, we really wanted to get a good variety of artists from different nations up and down the coast, including up in the Yukon, also just the mediums that they're working in. And we also wanted to try and work with artists that we haven't previously worked with here at the gallery before. Just because, you know, we're really about supporting emerging and mid-career artists. So we definitely wanted to get some good representation there.
You know, Indigenous art, and I think specifically Northwest Coast art, has been long a part of Canadian history, but we don't necessarily learn about it as much as we do, maybe, you know, something like Emily Carr or the Group of Seven, for example. How can an event like this not only promote these artists, but also educate those who aren't a part of the traditional tribes and the Northwest Coast community?
We are, well, we strongly believe, of course, that art is a way of instigating conversations. And so when people come into the Bill Reed Gallery, yes, they're looking at beautiful artwork, but they're also learning about many of the issues and concerns of Indigenous people today and in the past. Bill Reed's story himself, his mother was in residential school. He was very affected by the colonial forces that are part of the conversation in the media today and that people are really wanting to learn about and understand. So Bill grew up outside of his Haida culture, and it was only in his late teens, early 20s that he started to reconnect. And this is a story we hear over and over again. So Bill Reed's art speaks to building that sense of identity and community and connection that so many Indigenous people are discussing today. But it also shares that story with a wider audience, with tourists from around the world, with other people here on the Northwest Coast or just visiting or who live here, with the settler communities. And so, and then the artists and the pieces that we've chosen for the show, they introduce other themes and ideas, the importance of activism in the community, the importance of how we, the things we wear and choose to wear on a daily basis, not just for special and for special occasions, as being symbols of our personal identity. And so we have a couple of fashion pieces in the show that really talk about this idea of modern contemporary regalia that is meant to be worn on a daily basis and continue to spread these ideas and connections. Do you want to add anything?
No, I think you kind of covered it all. Yeah.
You know, the Northwest peoples, I think, have a long history of storytelling, whether it's oral or visual artistic. Where does that tradition come from, do you think? Is it something that's just been always very innate in that culture?
Yeah, I'm Anishinaabe from the prairies, and just thinking about like my own nation, it is such an important and integral part of teaching and passing down teaching and knowledge. So it's kind of just, it's always been a part of, I mean, kind of all over Canada and all over the states. Our cultures are rooted in oral histories and stories, and that's really how everybody learns, you know, the traditional ways. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here on the coast, the art form is really translating many of those oral traditions and stories into a more physical way. Each nation, Indigenous nation, represents their stories in different ways. Here on the coast, we have totem poles which share stories. We have masks and regalia and house fronts and paintings, this very distinctive and elaborate art form that has inspired people and is a great way to share kind of an understanding of the world around us.
I know two of the artists that are mentioned in the press release for this are Black Button Blanket Earrings by Natasha Seymour, which is, I believe, a beaded thing. And then the Silkscreen Print Protector by Maynard Johnny Jr. What can you tell us about those two particular art pieces?
I'll start with Maynard's work. Maynard is from the Coast Salish and Kwakwaka'wakw Nations. So he has really built a focus on Salish art forms. And that's a big interest to us these days because Bill Reed is Haida. And so in general, the Haida people practice a more northern style of art. And here in Vancouver, it is Coast Salish territory. We're very proud to be on the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh territories. And the style of Salish art and some of the messages and stories being told in Salish art are quite different than the northern style of art. So it was very important to us that we did include a number of Salish artists in the show to help clarify that both the stylistic changes and also the growing emphasis on making sure that we aren't considering the people and the artists of the Northwest Coast as one thing. There's many, many distinctive styles, and each of the artists in the show really has found their own personal style and is celebrating that. I'm going to let you talk about Natasha's.
Yeah, Natasha is Tahltan, Tlingit, and Nishka, which is more northern style. Traditionally, there is beadwork found up there, but the style that Natasha is working in with her button blanket earrings is very contemporary. Beaded earrings are kind of something that has really blown up in the last few years on Instagram and Facebook. And she is herself a really incredible beader. And she's sharing her knowledge of the traditional button blankets that are worn as regalia, but kind of changing it and putting it into like earring form. So just the way that she has transformed this like traditional regalia into more of like a contemporary type of regalia is really something that I think really stood out. And that's part of the reason why we chose her for this exhibition.
You mentioned Instagram and Facebook, and you know, we're seeing a lot of different trends on social media or a lot of different types of art, you know, especially in a thing like TikTok. How do you think that has helped or affected how people understand and their knowledge of what traditional art is?
I'll start by just saying that, you know, contemporary art and artists and Indigenous people are dynamic, growing, changing, beautiful cultural traditions. And, you know, we sometimes I think when people look at classic styles of Indigenous art, they think that change hasn't been occurring in the art forms. This show is very much about how art is continuing to develop and change and grow, and is specifically a snapshot of the 25 years since Bill Reid passed away. But he was instrumental in causing so much of that change. And that was before TikTok and Instagram. But I know Alia really follows a lot of artists online, and maybe yeah, you could talk about the social media.
Yeah, and it's definitely made it a lot more accessible. Like, I come from the prairies, and there are lots of artists that I know from that region. But after moving out here to the coast, like, I actually moved here during the pandemic, so I wasn't really able to go out and meet people as much, but Instagram kind of allowed me to be able to become more familiar with certain people's artworks. And even for like non-Indigenous people, it's become a way to access that art and for Indigenous artists to share their work in definitely a more accessible way.
Mm-hmm. I think the pandemic is another interesting thing to look at. You know, because we've heard, especially in Vancouver, about all, you know, everything took a hit. But as a small business yourself, how did the gallery weather the storm of the pandemic?
So the Bill Reid Gallery is run by the Bill Reid Foundation. So we are a nonprofit, non-governmental educational organization. So we're very independent. I think the COVID and the pandemic was a very difficult time, but we're also very nimble because we are not hindered by a large bureaucracy or so even we're a very lean and mean kind of organization. So I do feel that, you know, people use the term pivot a lot during the pandemic. I do think we were able to pivot a lot of our programs online. We continued, we shut the doors for 3 months, but really kept going. We had our exhibitions, and really coming into a gallery space was one of the safest places you could come. You know, lots of space, lots of room, quiet, not crowded, yet very engaging and interesting. And then we ran a lot of our workshops, our artist talks, our openings, everything online. And that helped us a lot with staying connected to our community. Financially, we are very grateful to the government for the extra support they provided to small businesses during that time. And that really did help us get through. It's still a struggle because our audience numbers are still, you know, a portion of our funds come through people actually paying at the door. And that is a slow build up again. Just to mention that we do offer free admission all the time for Indigenous community members. And that's very important to us because we feel like we're a voice for Indigenous artists and their communities. Would you like to add anything else?
Okay. How do you find, has it been, I don't want to use the word struggle, but are there certain challenges, especially coming out of a time like this, in attracting new people, younger people to come to a gallery or to come to an art show?
I don't know. I think it's kind of hard to say. It really depends on the content of our exhibition. Last year, I had the opportunity to curate my first exhibition, and it was focused on beadwork. And I feel like it brought in quite a lot of people that maybe another exhibition might not have, because it's the exhibition was very closely tied with like the online beadwork community. And because people saw it online, that drew them into the gallery here. So I think in using social media, it's been a great help in getting the word out to people and also bringing them in to be interested in what we're doing here at the gallery.
And for other, you know, we do change our exhibitions on a fairly regular basis. And we are always, as Alia mentioned previously, very interested in supporting and early career artists. And we have been able to feature a number of younger artists in our exhibitions, and it continues to amaze us how much they are, you know, feel pride in being able to show their own work in adjacent to Bill Reed's work. And it's kind of how this exhibition grew, because this even the youngest artists still look to him as a leader. And so I think that idea that the arts community and the Indigenous arts community is just really blossoming right now really, I think, important for people who come to the gallery to understand, and to and it also does bring in friends and family as well.
You know, you mentioned it's been 25 years since Bill Reed's passing, and the word legacy gets thrown around a lot. And with Bill, and in creating this exhibit and talking to these artists, what do you think Bill Reed's legacy or impact is?
Yeah, well, I mean, with this exhibition, like the artists who submitted their work, like specifically stated that they were really impacted by Bill and his work. And in particular, there's a couple of pieces, or one artist in particular who created this beautiful copper hat. And the technique that he used was a technique that actually Bill brought here to the Northwest Coast and introduced. So from Bill, that kind of grew into other artists using these techniques. So you can even see like the direct links that Bill had brought here.
A couple of other things artists are saying is that Bill inspired them to always be critical of their own work. He had a very well-known statement talking about the well-made object, and he really believed in pushing yourself to always be improving. He also really believed that you needed to look and understand the historic art and feel very, you know, have a deep understanding of the forms and the meaning of the historic art before you could then branch out and start doing something new and different and build your own personal style. So, you know, traditionally people would have learned by copying historic pieces or working alongside a master to create historic pieces and build. So many of these artists have done that. They've dug deep into their own cultural roots and learned from mentors and also kind of practiced a critical self-awareness. So those are the types of things that people are really mentioning to us. The last thing I'll mention is that Bill, in his later years, became quite an activist, standing up for the rights of Indigenous people. And through his art and also through actually actively participating in rallies and speaking with government. So I think that has always been an inspiration for people. And Bill, I'm not sure if you knew, suffered from Parkinson's disease for the last 30 years of his life. And that became very debilitating for him in his later years. And even through the pain and the suffering of the Parkinson's, he never stopped creating art. And he was willing to go out there and stand up and speak for his people. So I think he's impressive in so many ways. Yeah.
On that note, is art inherently political?
I don't know. It kind of depends on the artist. I think it's also kind of hard to differentiate when it comes to contemporary Indigenous art, because so many Indigenous artists are really inspired by contemporary Indigenous issues. So it's really hard to kind of separate those two things.
Mm-hmm. Even the idea of creating a piece in a very traditional style and a piece of regalia, because of course regalia making and dancing and potlatching and all of those things were banned for many years. So there could be something to what you're suggesting, the idea that making a piece of very classic regalia for use in your community in a traditional form is a rebellious act because it was pushed underground for so many years. The art never disappeared, but it was definitely hindered by all of these colonial forces. And one of our artists, Natasha, actually the one who made the earrings, she spoke and said that learning to bead and learning to make earrings was something that happened. She did as a healing process. She went through some personal trauma and returning to the art forms and learning more about her traditions has helped her to heal and grow as a person.
And of course, Bright Futures isn't just a gallery exhibit. I know you have other events as well. Talk about what else you're doing in addition to the specific exhibit.
So we'll start with our grand opening on the Tuesday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. April 25th, and it is open to the public. So we hope many people will come and meet the artists and see the show. We haven't got all of our plans but in place right now, but the show will be up till the end of the year, so it's a fairly lengthy show, and through the course of that we will be doing a number of workshops, a number of artist presentations, curatorial tours of the exhibition, and we have a couple of artist markets coming up. We're always coming up with new and fun things. So we encourage people to sign up for our e-newsletter. It comes out once a month. We don't bombard your inbox, and to stay on top of what's being planned.
Well, it is Bright Futures at the Bill Reed Gallery, which is on from April 26th until January 14th next year. And your grand opening is the night before on April the 25th.
Right.
Beth Carter, Aliyah Bubar, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah.
Alrighty, have a good rest of your day.
Okay, take care.
And that was my conversation with Beth Carter and Aliyah Bubar. They are the curators of the Bill Reed Gallery in Vancouver. And they're putting on a new exhibit entitled Bright Futures. They have a special opening event tomorrow, and then the exhibit runs from April 26th until January 14th. That does it for me today. My thanks to Aaliyah and Beth. My thanks also to Scout Taylor Compton. Her new film, Best Man, is out now. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.